We demystify what goes on behind the therapy room door. Join us on this voyage of discovery and co-creative conversations. This is the Therapy Show, Behind Closed Doors podcast with Bob Cook and Jackie Jones.
Welcome to the next episode of the Therapy Show, Behind Closed Doors, with the wonderful, as always, Mr. Bob Cook and myself, Jackie Jones. And we're on episode 153.
Like you're heading towards the 3-year anniversary.
Absolutely. We've only got another couple and then it's there. And what we're going to be talking about this one, which I love this topic, Bob, because I talk about this an awful lot, is making peace with your inner critic in the therapy process. My inner critic is always chirruping away.
Wonderful title again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so just say it again. How to...
Making peace with your inner critic in the therapy process.
Okay. So if we were to look at one of the major outcomes of a psychotherapy treatment process, even if our clients don't say this in this sort of language, this is probably one of the outcomes.
Yes.
That the client can eventually get some peace from the never-ending critic, which is usually pecking away at the head, heart, and spirit.
Yeah. I think there's lots of different names for what we refer to as the inner critic.
Often people, name a few?
Well, yeah, often people call it mind monkeys. Do you know what I mean? It's just when you're trying to do something and then there's just that little voice in your head that's saying things like, should you really be doing that? Or it won't work out. It never works for you. All those sort of things that we wouldn't dream of saying to anybody else. But for some reason, that internal dialogue goes on in our head.
Yeah, or the toxic parent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the negative parent.
Yeah.
Or the critical parent.
Because that's where it all comes from, isn't it?
Well, sometimes in TA, you see, transaction analysis again, Eric Byrne talked about the negative controlling parent. All the same sort of terminology, really. It might have got changed over the years or by different disciplines, but it's the that narrative which is continually dismissing, attacking, diminishing our sense of self.
Yeah, and we're both parents, and I don't want to be slating all parents, but it's usually our main caregiver or somebody that we've, I don't know, respected or has meant a lot to us in our upbringing. So it could be a teacher, it could be an aunt, it could be a foster carer or grandparents or whatever. It's somebody in our past that has kind of said certain things, or we've got a feeling from them. They've not necessarily given us a direct message, but it's kind of like the understanding that we have.
Yeah, and that we take on by osmosis, or some people might say an unconscious process.
Yeah.
The process which is often outside our awareness.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest jobs a therapist has, I think, in this context, is to facilitate the client to understand that this critic, TA negative parent, did he say monkey business or monkey something?
Mind monkeys, just mind those little monkeys that are chirping away, yeah.
Actually comes from an outside source.
Yes.
It's not ourselves.
Yeah. I think that's the important thing, that it's not our voice that's in there, yeah.
Even though we feel or might think that it's actually ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And that it is just a thought. We don't need to believe the things that it's saying, but we do.
Well, we take these narratives, or if we want a technical word, our interjected parental messages, the negative ones I'm talking about here, not the positive ones.
Yeah.
The critic ones, very early on. and they become part of our personality, which is why we often think it's ourselves rather than imported from somewhere else.
Yeah.
As I said, the major job I think of a therapist in this context is to help the client be aware that this negative critic we're talking about here comes from elsewhere and is imported in rather than from themselves, which they often think it is.
And again, I know we've said it in previous podcasts and everything. I think you hit on it there when you said to become aware of. Awareness, for me, is key to everything.
Mm.
You know, that it's like a running commentary that's always running in the background, but often we're not even aware of it. But yet it does often dictate the behaviour that we take in certain situations.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, the biggest question I could ask you and I ask myself in this podcast is, how do we facilitate the clients to be aware that actually the negative critical parent that they listen to and often attack themselves with comes from an external source and it is not them? How do we help the client actually come to that point of awareness?
That's a really good point.
I mean, I'll start with you.
Well, I sometimes ask, you know, clients, whose voice is it?
Mm.
Yeah.
Basically. And is that enough in itself?
Well, it starts the conversation. Mm. Do you know what I mean? To look at that, is it your voice? Do you believe that it is your voice? And then we can start the conversation about, okay, so whose voice is it?
Right. So let me give you a negative rhetoric, which is often so common when people come into therapy and talk about being very hard on themselves. Or I might ask that question, are you very hard on yourselves?
Yeah.
And they say yes. So sort of thing they might say to themselves is, I've got it wrong again.
Yeah.
I'm really stupid. I can never get things right. I have no value. I'm worthless. I might as well give up. I can never get things right. I'm completely wrong. I never amount to anything.
Yeah.
Those are common internal critic voices which a person might report when they talk about being hard on themselves as a narrative that comes internally rather than externally.
Yeah.
So a good question is, like you've just said, and have you heard this narrative before, or where did you get this narrative, or how did you come to this conclusion, or has anybody said similar things to you?
Yeah.
Are you always this hard on yourself? Has this come from your history? Is there a pattern here? Is this useful, this language?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like this type of narrative will only have one function, and that's to diminish your sense of self and deplete your self-esteem.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when I have had this conversation with clients, one of the first things that they'll say, if I say that, you know, has anybody ever said this to you? Or, you know, can you remember a time where somebody said this or whatever? They've always said no. So from that, I would then say the feeling that is attached to it or how you feel, is that familiar to you?
And then what happens when you say that?
Then they can make a connection to somebody or a time in their life where they felt that same feeling that's attached to it, rather than the actual words being spoken.
So they might not remember the narrative.
Yeah.
Or put it another way, they might not allow themselves to put that connection together of whose narrative actually is.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important point. Yeah.
It's different. But what you're saying is they may actually feel what it's like. And usually it's how the feelings of how they are when those things are told to them is usually what they remember.
Yeah.
And they may from that make a connection of who actually says it.
Yeah.
Even if it's a commoloration of people. In other words, it's more than one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, for example, if you come from a big family of 11 people, for example, it's often might be the older brothers or sisters as they work up the chain.
Yes. Yeah. Because I think if they do attach it to a person, then there's a sense of grief and loss potentially around that when they realise that, you know, it was a parent that said that to them, or it was a parent that made them feel that way.
Or a significant other
person, absolutely.
Such as an older brother or sister.
Yeah.
I mean, another query on this is often, and I might ask this, oh, that's interesting, you're so hard on yourself, and it's also interesting, don't remember where it comes from. However, if we were to inquire further, what do you think the psychological function might be of this dialogue, which is so critical, that you are imposing on yourself? What do you think is the psychological function of that?
Yeah.
And then they might say, well, there's none at all, except that I feel bad. Oh, so that might be the psychological function, that you then feel bad. And who might have wanted you in your history, but not be one person, might be part of yourself, that wants you to feel so bad about yourself? Those are the sort of questions, I think. That's the sort of inquiry. And they might say it's part of themselves, by the way.
Yes.
They might say, oh, it's just that part of himself which always wants to tell me off. And then the next question is, oh, and where do you think the other part of you has learned this from? So you're aiming towards, like you've just said, Jackie, they're making some sort of connection with this negative critique is imported in from somewhere.
Yeah.
You see, what usually happens when, whether it be mother, father, brother, older sister, older brother, or whichever negative critique we're talking about here, what usually happens is that the client changes the you to an I.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you are this, you are that, you could be this. You are the negative, the person got it wrong, the person who won't amount to anything.
Yeah.
You are the black sheep of this family. You cause all the problems. And if that's said over and over and over, either verbally or non-verbally, especially the younger they are, the client then decides, or the person then decides, or the child then decides, I am that way. They change the you to an I.
Yeah.
They take ownership of the I without, or it gets lost in time, with a really understanding that is actually imported from somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. Mm. And I like what you said earlier on about osmosis. That's a word that I use quite a lot, that it just kind of seeps in. And I think one of the reasons I think that is because we trust those people around us, that they've got our best interests at heart. So we don't tend to filter out those messages.
Mm.
As an adult now and in the here and now, if somebody was saying those things to me, I wouldn't take them on board. I'd probably think they're having a bad day or what's wrong with them. Whereas the age that we're starting to notice this, we're too young to filter it out or to work it out whether it's true or not true.
Mm.
So we just absorb it.
Okay. So if we follow this through, as they start to make the awareness or connection or take ownership that this is imported material,
yeah,
and something from birth they've suddenly decided, but they've decided these things in impact from what has come from somewhere else. So they start to differentiate out and take ownership of this difference. They then can start, through our help, to take ownership of their own power and self-agency back from what they gave away.
Yeah. And that sounds like a really good process, but it's quite difficult to do.
Well, it's quite a lengthy process. And the first place, and I know you like this, well, I'm going to say, and I do as well, because I have the same belief systems. The first place is awareness and connection.
Yes. Yeah.
And not your awareness and connection, them making an awareness and connection that this critique they're always telling themselves isn't them telling it themselves. It actually comes from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And how come they're believing that?
Yeah.
Where that all comes from. So that's the first step, the awareness and connection of this process. How you get to it, I believe, is through inquiry questions.
Yeah.
Also helping the clients see that often this narrative is taken from an external place, parent will say here in TA terms, as adult reality, as if it was true now.
Yes. Yeah.
Which in TA we call contaminations. So we have to start helping the person make awareness. As they start to do that, the next step is to help them in their story make connections with who might have said that, or where does that come from? Many may come from many sources in the family. It might come from teachers, might come from abusers. It might come from brothers, sisters. It could come from the church, could come from many places, and help them trace this back.
Yeah.
Which takes time.
Absolutely. But if we can work out the source, then we can start to pull apart the story that we make up about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and usually what we come across is loyal children.
Yes, yeah.
Most people are very loyal to the significant other people who are in charge of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if they start, realizing or making connections that those people, you know, or actually saying these negative things to them, that a lot comes from that, Jackie. Firstly, of course, they are then, you know, starting to perhaps think of their significant others who were part of that process as not okay. And once they start doing that, that starts to change their whole script, and there's a lot to that as they start to unpick all that. It's not straightforward.
Absolutely. And that is a massive shift in things. And sometimes I think for me, that was one of the hardest things when I was going through my own personal therapy, because it's kind of like your whole story falls apart somehow. Even though the story isn't a good one as it stands, at least it's a story. And it's an anchor. Whereas when we start to look at it and understand where it's coming from and why we've got it, everything kind of changes after that.
Mm. Oh, I like that word anchor, because that story that we've developed, you know, about ourselves, other people in the world, provides predictability, identity, stability, continuity, all those things which make up our life story about ourselves, other people in the world. Now, as we start to change that, we then start to feel often very uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I think, you know, some of the conversations that I've had with clients in the past, they're like, you know, why would I want to keep this story or this script alive when I feel as bad as I do? But that is exactly it, because it's familiar, because we know it, it's an anchor, it's our kind of safety mechanism to a certain extent. So to let that go, we're floundering.
Yeah. Psychological functions of keeping that going is to provide predictability,
yeah,
continuity,
yeah,
psychological stability, and a confirmation of how we see ourselves and our identity.
Yeah.
So those are the reasons how come we spend so much energy,
yeah,
and so much time in continuing this story about ourselves. And TA often called our script.
Yeah.
That are the people, ourselves, and the world. Now, this type of script or this type of narrative depletes any self-esteem that we might have actually managed to garner about ourselves.
Yeah.
So we have to tackle this and the psychological functions of this type of negative critique that we say to ourselves to enable the person to develop more self-esteem, confidence in themselves and in the world and feel better.
Yeah. And one feeds the other. When we're in a good place, we can kind of understand it more and we can build our self-esteem. But when we're not in a good place, when we're tired or overwhelmed or anything, that's the time where we can kind of slip back into it because it's familiar. We know how it works.
You couldn't have said that better. The more stressed we are,
yeah,
the more likely we are to fall into our habitual patterns and the elements of our negative script.
Yeah.
When we are feeling more vulnerable and stressed.
Somebody asked me a question, a client. I was having this discussion with a client last week or the week before, and they asked me a really, I thought it was quite a pertinent question, and I've never been asked it before. Because we were talking about the life script, and I was having this conversation about how we can get out of our script. And he said, so is that it then? Once you get out of your script, you never go back to it. And I said, well, no, it doesn't really work that way. We, you know, life throws us a curveball or life events happen and everything, and we will go back. And he said, what's the point? And I said, well, the point is we're more aware of when we're in it. And then we have a choice to step out of it. I still go back into my script, but I know when I'm in it now. It's not out of my awareness anymore. And sometimes I want to be in it, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Yeah, because you then know who you are from all these years ago. But let's go back to what you just said. What is the question you haven't been asked before?
Do we, once we step out of it, do we never go back in it again?
And you've never been asked that before?
No.
Variation?
No.
Oh, okay. So I think the way you responded to that question is really positive. That exactly what you just talked about, that by understanding the pitfalls, the understanding our vulnerability, and understanding that under stress, we're likely to allow those negative critical voices to be more powerful. And we'll allow ourselves to fall into our negative stories. And if we become aware of all those things we just talked about, we can step away from that negative story and start creating our own positive story instead of someone else's.
Yeah.
Because what we're talking about here, Jack, is that we are living somebody else's version of ourselves.
Yeah.
We are living somebody else's version of ourselves.
And we believe it. That's the thing. We believe it. So
of course we do.
True, yeah.
It comes from those very important, significant other people who have spent such a long time defining us in such a way.
Yeah.
what else could we believe? Because we don't know anything else.
Yeah.
But now, however long decades it is, till the client can't accept the discomfort anymore and they come to therapy, we can help them, you know, take back their own versions of themselves again.
Yeah.
And take ownership of those versions. Now, that's not a six-session process.
No.
This takes time. But in answer to the question the person asks is, why would you do it? Well, why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Why would you stay with those processes, that uncomfortability, that discomfort, that negative version of yourself? Why wouldn't you? And of course, the question, the answer to that one is, well, because I feel so vulnerable in giving these, or this understanding of my story up, because what do I put in its place?
Yeah. Who am I?
Yeah. Who am I? That's it. That's the essential question. Who am I and who are you?
Yeah. And that's scary. And, you know, again, that's something that I will often say to clients is, when we're doing this work, you know, there is the chance that you will feel anxious. You will feel a shift at certain times when you're stepping out of your script. But that is OK, because it is new and it is different.
I saw a film in 2011. For the first time, which had one of my favourite actresses in it, Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
It was called One Day. And it traced the 21-year-old Anne Hathaway, whose name I can't remember off the top of the head, the character she played, but she was just leaving Edinburgh University, or she was just graduating, and she met a fellow student she'd seen around before and really found attractive, I think the graduation party or whatever it was, and they met up for one night. They didn't actually come that intimate with each other, but they met up on July 15th, which is St. Swithin's Day, and they decided that they were going to meet up every year, or get in touch at least every year on July 15th for the rest of their lives.
Oh.
And the film takes us through the next 25 years of each one of these days, where they meet up or keep in contact with each other, and how their lives change and doesn't change, and how they're so intertwined together over the next 25, 26 years. And you see the script, or the life plan, or what they've decided with themselves and each other, and the impact of those two scripts together over the next 20 years, and their different developmental processes that go through, and how it ends. I won't tell you the ending in case
no,
you
don't, because I might Google it and see if I can watch
because
it.
Because the new version of that, like, you know, Starring Bourne, you get one version of it, goes through different geckos.
Yeah.
Popped into my Netflix 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Anne Hathaway's, you know, these two different actresses and actors. And it's got 12 episodes to it, so it's in more fuller version than the film. Though I did enjoy the book as well. But it's a really good example of how we play out our script, and we find people to play out our scripts with us, and how we develop or change or don't as the years go on.
Yeah.
Which is what I'm talking about here.
Yeah. And I think in my training, it was like, literally, when we talk about a life script, it is like a drama or an episode of Coronation Street or something, because we decide who comes into it and who we're going to have relationships with and everything. But it's kind of predetermined in a way by those messages and that internal critic of our perception of ourselves and who we will be in a relationship with.
Absolutely.
Which is shocking when you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, do we have free will?
Well, the next bit is what we do as therapists in helping the client give back and take ownership of those negative messages, how do we actually do it? Now, you and I have probably got different styles again in this. and you can do it from help the client make awarenesses through inquiry and in transaction analysis terms again, stay in their adult state, or stroke and you can use regression to help the client go back to the younger self when these messages and early negative critiques were actually given to them. And through role play in the regressive process, you can help the person give back those messages to where they first came.
Yeah.
And then to help them put a new script on the road, as Eric Burns said.
Yeah. Do you think...
Occasionally, yeah, now and again. I do think... Sorry, I'm jacking. Do I think what?
No. Do you think that sometimes our scripts are generational?
They're always generational. What else could there be?
Yeah, because I can remember something in my training about, I think it was your darling wife, Steffi.
Definitely, yeah.
That was saying about it's like an amphitheatre.
Yes.
And all these people in there.
Yes.
And it's about giving it back to the person it originally came from, type of thing. I don't know if it was a visualization thing that she got us doing.
Absolutely correct. On my, I have very, very a few photographs of myself when I was younger, and very few photographs of my adopted mother. But I have one on my phone. And I was looking at, I don't often look at these pictures, but I was looking at her and she was about, whoa, I don't know, 44 in the picture. And as I looked at her, I thought of what she said about her mother to me.
Yeah.
And how much she found her mother a cold fish. And that's the way I saw my own mother.
Yeah.
So she talked about her mother as being a cold fish and never expressing any love to her. I would say exactly the same thing about my mother as a cold fish that doesn't express any love. There's a generational script.
Yeah.
The etiology of a generational script, the beginning of a generational script, and many other things. But that's a good example of how things are passed down, or how people's experiences, images are passed down, and the stories that are passed down, and what we make sense of when my mother says, well, my mother was a cold fish and didn't express any emotion to me at all. What I, as I experienced that myself from my own mother, what I then decide.
Yeah.
Do I then eventually, out of awareness, pass down to my own? Never. Because, well, I've never have, for lots of different reasons. Mainly because of the therapeutic journey I've been in, because I was in therapy way before I had my daughter. And I knew the powerfulness of script and what not to pass down.
I think
generational skips are very important.
Yeah, I think that's the thing for me that I love about psychotherapy is that once we're aware and we have choices, then, you know, those choices are so important that we can stop that generational thing, do you know what I mean? And we can choose to be different with our children, but we need that awareness of it. I think this should be taught in flipping schools, you know, a lot of the time.
I was very fortunate to, before Jessica was born in 1999, and I was 48, so quite getting on in life. God knows what I would have been like at 28, because I wouldn't have had any therapy, or I wouldn't have had any understanding of myself and any of the things we're talking about here.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I would have passed down a very different life script, because I wouldn't have had any knowledge of any difference.
Yeah.
It was the therapeutic process I've had for many years that allowed me to, I hope, not understand these generational scripts, but to change them.
Yeah.
So
interesting conversation, Bob.
Yeah, so this is how I think we start desensitizing ourselves to these critical messages and taking ownership of a different way of being, so we can have a different destiny for ourselves, children, and if we don't have children, for ourselves and people around ourselves.
Yeah, I think one of the things I do sort of short term with clients sometime, again, for me, it's about increasing their awareness on things. And I call it taking the thoughts to court.
Yeah, I love that phrase of yours.
And, you know, getting them to challenge that negative, you know, that internal critic that they're getting, that you're not successful, you're not good enough, you're not the... Think of a time where you have been good enough and you have been successful, and trying to get them to reframe it, you know, in the short term. Obviously, there's a lot of deeper work that needs to go.
Yeah, you could set out regressively a court drama.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah. And that's what I picture in my head when I say take it to court. You are literally looking for evidence, you know, to discount that thought. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, psychodrama, all the, you know, these other types of psychotherapy, which we can use in transaction analysis to actually create court that you're talking about, so that they're trying to take ownership of what is so different and what should have been.
Yes.
We've denied them.
Yeah. And again, that's a grieving process a lot of the time.
Oh, well, that's the bit. We haven't mentioned on this podcast. Yeah. Is the loss of what could have been.
Yes.
And the celebration of what new ways we are.
Yeah.
Taking on board and our different destinies. But you're right. The loss of what could have been and should have been.
Yeah. So that's the deeper work, that, and that's why none of this is a quick fix.
Oh, this is not a quick fix.
Yeah.
It cannot be a quick fix.
Yeah. Again, I think I've really enjoyed that. I love talking about the inner critic, probably because mine is so very strong, Bob. And, you know, often I talk about having to have your hands on the steering wheel all the time, because if ever I let it go, it's so easy to just revert back into those thoughts. I consciously have to challenge them.
Yeah. And I think for those people, you know, listening to podcasts, therapists and clients alike who might be therapists, by the way, I really want to give a plea here for relational psychotherapy.
Yeah.
In other words, this isn't about doing this yourself. You can't do this yourself. You need to have a protective witness on the journey to be there for you as you start to not only make the connections, but actually perhaps giving back what was never yours.
I think for me, one of the things that I got that was so powerful on my psychotherapy journey as a client was validation.
Yes.
For the experience or how I felt or whatever it was. It was having that external validation for me that was so powerful.
And that has to come from the therapist on the journey. It can come from other people around, but in terms of the transference, which I, you know, is so important here, that the therapist is a protective, positive other to be able to stand up to often the negative critics in our head. Because if the therapist can't do that, a client repeats history.
Yeah. And again, you know, another thing, I love my training, Bob. I sing your praises all the bloody time. It's that permission, protection, and potency.
Yes.
It's always in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The therapist, I hope, think that way, because we're so important to our clients.
Yeah.
In this journey we're talking about here, they cannot do it themselves.
Yeah. And I agree. My first job when I left school was to be a hairdresser.
Oh, wow.
And I refer to counselling the same as a hairdresser. I can't do my own hair.
No, you
Same
can't.
As I can't give therapy to myself. I need to go to a hairdresser's to get a decent haircut. You
That
know, I
is
can
on
trim
your
my fringe a
side.
little bit and I can do bits and bobs,
Yeah.
but I can't see the back of my head, so I can't do it myself. And it's similar to I can't give myself psychotherapy.
No, we do need to have the therapist that is on our side and is powerfully on our side and will stay around and be there for our journey.
Yeah, I think it's a relationship that you can't replicate in any other area of your life.
No, and
personally.
rightly so.
Yeah, absolutely. So until next time, Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And what we'll be looking at in the next one is overcoming child neglect in therapy. Another.
We'll go together.
Yes, absolutely.
Bye-bye. See you then.
See you soon.
You've been listening to The Therapy Show. Behind Closed Doors podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. We'll be back next week with another episode.